Alrighty, this is week one, class two of TH 308, the first part of the blood covenant. So we're talking about the fact that the blood covenant originated with God, and we can find the origins all the way back in the book of Genesis. And along with that is the fact that we have to come to the place of being willing to accept that God's word really is the source for just about everything that we need. In other words, that's where we can find answers. Now, when you talk about the blood covenant, covenant itself, the blood covenant is the most binding of all covenants. And there are many types of covenants within various cultures, and there are a lot of different books you can read about. In fact, that book by H. Clay Trumbull, it not only talks about blood covenants, but it does talk about some other things as well. But there are all different types of covenants that have existed within different cultures, but the most binding of all covenants is the blood covenant. Now, in the Hebrew, this blood covenant is the berith. And in the Greek, it's the same type of covenant, but the word is diatheke. Now, there are different types of covenants referred to in Scripture, but the blood covenant is really the most predominant. And here's what's interesting. When you go through Scripture and you read things about covenants, many times the covenants that it's referring to, like a particular passage, is not a covenant that that started at that moment, but it's a covenant that took place previously and is being referred to. So the blood covenant is the most it's the most powerful, the most binding of all covenants. And once a blood covenant was established, it was considered to be unbreakable. Now, it's very important to remember, because when you start thinking in terms of a blood covenant being broken, and you begin thinking in terms of the fact that, yes, the blood of Jesus was involved in a covenant, then if a blood covenant is not to be broken, that says something about our relationship with God right there. And we'll talk about that somewhat tonight, a little bit later on. Now, when it comes to a covenant, once this berith was established, it would exist for generations to come. And they would refer to it. The generations might, you know, they might say something like, you know, the covenant, the berith of our forefathers, or whatever language they spoke, you know, the blood covenant of our ancestors and so forth. And this covenant, it could be established between two people, or two people groups, like, you know, two tribes, for example. And in modern nations and people groups, a blood covenant is virtually unheard of. When you went to get your car loan, did the banker pull out a knife and say, "Oh, but by the way, your signature is fine, we want more"? Have you ever heard the term when people talk about, you know, like collection agencies? No, these people want blood. But what are they talking about? Blood covenant. Well, we didn't know that. But it's not just they want to kill you. That's how that phrase originated. It's talking about a blood covenant. Now, when it comes to establishing a covenant, an agreement was made to enter into this berith. And you could not enter into a berith unless you wanted to. In other words, okay, yeah, I guess in theory somebody could be forced to do it. But that's not the way it worked. You had to be in agreement with the other person, or tribe had to be in agreement with tribe in order to enter into this this berith. And basically, to enter into a berith or a blood covenant, it was based on the friendship of the two people, or the friendship the two tribes had with each other. It could be, you know, the deep love that they felt for each other. You could have maybe two leaders. Let's just call them kings. Kings of two tribes, or chiefs of two tribes, and they're very, very close friends. And so what they want to do is establish a blood covenant between themselves, or between their two tribes. And a blood covenant could also be based on the strengths each person or tribe had to offer the other. I'll give you an example. When I taught this at the church, this is the example I used, or, you know, it was vaguely similar to it. You know, say you have one tribe that has a superior shield, and another tribe has a superior spear. Well, the one tribe has the strongest shield and the other tribe has the strongest spear. Well, they recognize the strengths of each other, but the spear tribe They don't just want the spears. They'd also like to have the shields. And the shield tribe, they don't just want the shields. They'd also like to have the spears. But that's not going to happen unless something takes place for these two tribes to come into agreement. And so the spear chief and the shield chief, they get together and they start talking. And they say, look, you've got the shield, or look, you've got the spear. You know, how's about if we enter into covenant with each other? We will share with you our spear technology, and you can share with us your shield technology. And the other chief says, boy, that sounds like a pretty good idea, because we got these wimpy spears. I mean, they break at nothing. And boy, sure would be nice to have those kind of spears to go along with our shields. So, okay, yeah, let's do it. And so they would agree to enter into this covenant based upon each other's strengths. Same thing could exist between two individuals. Now, if this berith was going to be entered into by two tribes, a man was selected as the representative for each tribe. And members of that tribe would act as witnesses. They would gather around, you know, to witness the entire thing. Now, if the berith were entered into by two individuals, they may or may not have witnesses. I can't say that it was a general practice to have witnesses, because it might not have been. In fact, later on, not tonight, but later on, we may take a look at the covenant that existed between Jonathan and David, and how that was a berith that they entered into. But apparently there were no witnesses when this took place. But nevertheless, whether you had witnesses as individuals or not, the covenant was still just as binding. Now, when you talk about establishing this blood covenant, there was a very specific set of steps that they would take to do this. First off, you had to enter into the agreement, we're going to do this. And it's a very serious thing. You know, nowadays, and we'll talk about contracts here in just a few moments, but people enter into contracts, but it means nothing. Because, you know, you can always wrangle your way out of a legal contract and all this other kind of stuff. But a blood covenant, when you have a blood covenant mindset, you understand that you cannot get out of it. Therefore, you better not enter into it unless you mean business. And unless you're willing for this to be not just a lifetime, but a generational time. I mean, it's just going to carry on. So unless you're willing to make that kind of a commitment to the other person or to the other tribe, you did not enter into a blood covenant. It was that serious. Our mindsets today, we do not understand anything that serious. There is nothing in our Western culture that is as binding or as serious as a blood covenant. But to the cultures back, let's just say it this way, to the Bible time cultures, okay, they understood the serious nature of a blood covenant. So, here you have these two people, they decide they're going to get into, establish this blood covenant. Well, the first thing they would do is take an animal, and usually it was a calf. And what they would do was kill this calf, you know, generally by slitting its throat. And then after they had killed this calf, they would begin to cut it right down the middle. And I can remember years ago when I first heard this, I'm thinking, you know, they cut it, you know, across the belly, you know, just cut it in half like that. But that's not how they did it. They would cut it from tail to nose, and they would cut right along the spine, literally dividing the spinal cord. This was not an easy thing to do, because they would have, start to veer off, they'd have to stop and slow down. And so they had to be very patient as they were making this cut, because what they wanted to do was end up with two equal halves. And so the two of, now, I want you to think with me for a moment. Think about the blood that would have been shed in this process. Think about how the ground would have been covered with blood. And if you have these two guys, whether it's two individuals or representatives of tribes, these two guys that are doing this, do you think there would have been any blood on them? I guarantee you blood. And back then, they didn't have Tide, all right? They didn't have Shout. They didn't have OxyClean or anything like that. So once something gets stained, man, I mean, it's stained. So here these two fellows are. They're entering into this berith. And the first thing they have to do is take this animal, and they kill this animal, and they divide it right down the middle, tail to nose, nose to tail, right down the middle to end up with two equal halves. Now, you're going to have to use your imagination. We're going to let this represent our calf, all right? I called the Humane Society, but they said you can't do things like this anymore. So, we're going to use two chairs. So they would cut this animal's throat. They would kill it. Because, see, how do you know they killed it, Brother Martin? Well, because an animal's not going to stand around unless you cut it right down the middle. It's going to dance all over the place. You follow me? So they killed the animal first. And maybe they didn't slit its throat. Maybe they just hit it with a rock or something. But they killed it first. Then they began cutting it from tail to nose, nose to tail, to make sure that they end up with two completely identical mirror, if you will, image parts. Now, once they did this, they would take that animal, that calf, and they would lay it out in such a way to where the part, the inside where they had made the cut, the innards, were facing upward on both halves, and the hooves were facing each other. Okay? Now, after they would do that, and I'm going to need some help here, and I know that Jimmy Miller wants to help me, so I'll just let him come on up. Doesn't he just look like somebody who wants to help? Now, you want to? We'll kind of follow along here in the syllabus as we go through this. Now, you'd have the one person would be standing like on one end of the animals after they go through cutting and all this other. Then the other person would be standing on the other end. Now, you've got these two animals right there in front of them. And remember now, all this blood, okay? And you got the two halves. Well, what they would do is walk in between the two parts, and they would stand there, having passed between the parts, the halves of the calf, and passing through the blood, walking right through it. And then after they had passed in between, they would be looking at each other. And what this represented is that we're entering into this berith, and I am willing to take your place in life, and you are willing to take my place in life. And then after they would go through the passing through the parts, they would exchange their names. So here's Jimmy Miller, and here's Jim Martin. Well, we've passed through the parts, and now we're going to exchange names. So I become Jim Martin Miller, and he becomes Jimmy Miller Martin. And from that point on, somebody would say, well, what is your name? And I would say, well, my name is Jim Martin Miller. They would understand that I have a berith, a blood covenant relationship with Jimmy Miller. Now, if Jimmy Miller is bad to the bone, they know that even though I may be a Wally Cox, I got a Rambo somewhere who is my covenant partner, okay? This could make an impression on somebody. You know what I'm saying? I'll give you an example. There's a guy I know. Brother Jerry met him today. His name is Kendall Harris. Big guy. You know, 6'7", 6'8", 300 pounds. And he, out of all of his brothers, like, you know, five brothers, there are like a total of five sons, I think it is. He's the smallest. They lived in Washington, lumberjacks, you know, the whole nine yards. You know, I think they've got Paul Bunyan jeans in them somewhere along, you know, big guy, gentle giant, so to speak. Well, one day, there was a bill collector or something of that nature, came to the house as the kids were growing up. And he knocks on the door, and Kendall's dad comes to the door. And they're standing out there, and they're talking, and this man's kind of giving Kendall's dad a hard time. Well, all of a sudden, the man stopped and walked away. What Kendall's dad didn't know was that Kendall and his brothers had all walked out of the house and were standing behind their dad, watching this man. It made an impression. And the man suddenly had a change of heart. And he decided, today is not the good day for me to be here. And so he left. All right, I've got Jimmy Miller as my covenant partner. I am Jim Martin Miller. So if there happen to be 20 different Miller families, and I tell somebody I'm Jim Martin Miller, they might not be sure if it's Rambo Miller or Wimpy Miller. But they might not be willing to take a chance to find out. All they know is, I now have covenanted with somebody else. Okay, now, to stay right there, covenant partner. Now, take a look in your outline. Let me get my coat here, because we're going to need this. You'll notice that after we've faced each other, we've exchanged names, then what we do is we exchange our robes or our coats. So we pass through. And I take off my robe, my coat, and I give him mine, and he gives me his. What this represents is that I now carry his authority. I am now robed in his authority. So when I go forth, it's not just that I'm going forth and saying, my name is Jim Martin Miller, but when people look at me, and you have to understand that in some cultures, they were identified by things they wore, like certain colors or certain designs on the color. Think in terms of cattle with a brand, something like that. So if they knew anything about, if they lived in that region and they understood, the people live here, the Millers live there, and the Joneses live over there, whatever. But will they see me walking along? And they might say, well, what are you doing with his robe on? I don't understand this. And I say, what's going on? I said, well, my name is now Jim Martin Miller. And they suddenly, boy, now they know. I have his robe. I have his authority. And I have his permission, having his name and his robe of authority, to act on his behalf, no matter where I go. And what this means is that I can go into the local department store. No, listen, I go down to the feed and farm store, all right? And I want to order some grain. Well, if I want to order this grain, I say, well, I need to get, so much grain. Maybe the owner of the store doesn't like me, but he sees that I'm carrying Jimmy Miller's authority. I'm walking in his authority. And maybe this man knows Jimmy and he likes Jimmy. He doesn't like me, but he likes Jimmy. But because I'm carrying Jimmy's authority with me everywhere I go, this man's going to give me what I want. He's going to give me what I... He may hate my guts, but he likes Jimmy. Now I have this berith with Jimmy. I have his robe. I have his authority. I have his right to act on his behalf, even if he and I aren't in the same house together, the same store together. We're not in the same city together, because I carry his authority everywhere I go. I act on his behalf. Now, after we do this, and I'm going to have to make a couple of arrangements here with this microphone. After we do this, we begin exchanging belts or girdles. Now, we don't wear girdles. But our wives have told us if we don't do something about this, we're going to have to start wearing them. Not really. Anyway, we exchange our belts. Now, do you have a belt?
Yeah.
Okay, well, now get with it, partner. Wait a minute. Wait. We're not going to get embarrassed here, are we?
I mean,
okay. So we exchange our belts, and, we don't have to loop it. We're just kind of hang it on here. Mine might not fit. Okay. Oops. Bad idea.
Purely decorative.
Just purely decorative. Okay. Now, our belt is the place where our sword hangs. And by exchanging our belts, we're exchanging our weapons. And in exchanging our weapons and our weapon belt, this is a declaration that from this day forward, I'm going to fight your battles. And he's saying the same thing to me, I will fight your battles. Meaning that from this day forward, I know that whenever I enter into a battle with somebody, or if I do, I do not enter into battle alone. I know that I have a blood covenant partner who will be there for me. And my blood covenant partner literally will give his life before standing by and allowing me to die in the heat of battle. But if I do fall in battle, he will not stop fighting. He will fight to the death to protect whatever is remaining of mine. My family, my house, my lands, my, whatever it would be. He fights to the death to protect what belongs to me. So I know this. See, this is another thing about the Rambo covenant partner. You've seen those swashbuckler movies, Errol Flynn, and all that. Okay, somebody decides they want to pick on me. But they know that Jimmy is bad to the bone. I mean, this guy, you know, he'll whoop you. And he's great with the sword. He'll cut you to shreds before you know that you've been cut. Well, this person is maybe trying to pick on me. They hear that I'm now Jim Martin Miller, and they see me carrying his robe of authority. They know also, according to blood covenant terms, Jimmy Miller's out there somewhere. And if they mess with me and they hurt me, if they incapacitate me in any way, if they kill me, they know that Jimmy's coming after them. And Jimmy's going to take up this fight. And Jimmy's going to take up this battle for me. I do not have to fight alone. The battle is no longer mine, but the battle is now my covenant partner's. Okay? All right, now, here we have our sword belts. If you look in your outline, the next thing that we would do is exchange purses. Well, just like Jimmy and I don't, you know, wear girdles, we don't carry, you don't carry a purse, do you? Hallelujah. That word purse, it means wallet. So,
handbag.
So what we do is we exchange our... Wait a minute.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I know what's in mine. Now, what this means is that from this day forward, from this moment of the Berith on the rest of our lives, he's saying, you never again have to worry about indebtedness. I guarantee that all your bills are going to be paid. You will never have to worry about the creditor coming to take what you have purchased. I guarantee that all your needs are going to be supplied. You never again have to worry about lack. Likewise, I'm saying the same thing to him. Jimmy, we're Berith partners now. And never again the rest of your life will you have to worry about lack. I will pay your bills. If you get behind, I will step in and see to it that everything is covered. And if anything ever happens to you, your family's taken care of. I will see to it that your children are, you know, educated according to the standards of the day and so forth. I'll see to it that they have a place to live. I will not let them be cast out on the streets. I will not let, you know, the land be taken away from them. It will be passed down to your heirs and so on and so forth. So we're making, can you see why? You better be sure you know what you're doing before you enter into this. Because if I'm a shyster, he's assuming to step in behind me. And if I'm out there ripping people off and doing things wrong, it's not just me they're going to come after. They're going to look for him because he's my covenant partner. See what I'm saying? And so you had better have a degree of trust and faith in each other before you're willing to accept that kind of responsibility. All right, now look in your outline. After we have exchanged our wallets, handbags, our purses, the next thing we do is we take a knife and we begin to shed our own blood. And here's where it gets fun. So, we get together. Now, come on over here. We get together and we take a knife and we use this knife and we make a cut right along our hand here. You know, I'm going to let you go first on this one. Just have at it, man. Just let... I think it's clean, but don't worry. So he cuts his hand, and then I cut my hand, and then what we do is put that on your hand. Our hands are now cut, and we have this. Well, let me see. You cut your hand. See what? Our hands are now cut. And we take our hands and we let the blood drip into a cup. And then as that blood drips into the cup, you know, obviously we don't stand until we bleed to death, but we let some blood drip into this cut. Then after we do that, we take some black powder and we rub the black powder into the cut. And when the cut heals, we have this permanent mark on our hand. So from this day forward, whenever we meet somebody and we say, hey, how you doing? They're going to see, even if it's a hot day and I'm not wearing the robe of authority, And even if they haven't heard me give them my name, they look at my hand and they see that I have entered into a blood covenant. And they know that if they do anything, they know that I've got a blood covenant partner out there somewhere. I have a baris with somebody. They know what this means. In our culture today, we have no clue. But back then in those days, it forced a person to stop for a moment and think about how they were going to deal with that individual, because that individual carries with him every day of his life the mark of the covenant. And it's going to be there forever. Okay, now, after we have done this, and we've got the powder rubbed in here, we begin making declarations to each other about the terms of the covenant. In other words, I tell him, you know, from this day forth, and I begin to speak blessings over him and over his life. I begin to tell him about the benefits of this covenant and what it means to him. And then likewise, I also begin to speak to him, but if you break this covenant, here are the bad things that will happen to you. And I begin to declare all the horrible things that are going to happen that will be done to him if he breaks this berith. Well, then he begins to speak to me and tell me all the benefits and all the blessings and all the good things that now have happened to me and are going to come into my life because I have entered into this berith with him. But then he also declares to me the bad things that will happen if I choose to break this berith or to violate the very essence of a blood covenant. And from this day forward, we know the blessings and the penalties associated with our berith. Now, you don't have to turn to it, but if you want to get a really good scriptural perspective of this, read Deuteronomy chapter 28. It's a perfect example of the blessings and the cursings related to a blood covenant. Now, after we do this, we would begin to eat the covenant meal. Now, the covenant meal usually had meat, bread, and wine, but many times, or sometimes, meat was not included, but the bread and the wine were constants. And so what we would do is we would take wine, and we would pour the wine into the cup so that it would be mixed with the blood. Now, the problem for the Jews was this. They were forbidden to drink blood. The life of the blood is in the blood. And so what they would do is use just wine, you know, grape juice, but they would use wine. And I believe it's Deuteronomy 32:14. It's listed there in your syllabus. This was referred to as the blood of the grape. Now, there is a belief that what they may have done is not just poured wine in, but they may have actually taken a grape and crushed that grape along with the wine that they put in there so that it would represent the blood. You know, it's like a human shedding blood. It would represent the skin being broken and the blood flowing out. But I haven't been able to confirm that, but it makes sense that something that maybe they did do that because of what it would represent. So then what we do is we have the wine mixed with the blood, and we would also have the bread, and we would take the bread, and we would break the bread, and then he would take some, and he would, you know, break off, you know, eat some of the bread, you know, a piece of the bread for himself. Then I would take a piece here, and I would eat it. It is good. And eat it. And wish I had taken a smaller piece. And then what we would do is we would drink the wine that had been mixed with our blood. Okay. After we've done that, we would make a declaration to each other. From this day forth, I am blood of your blood and flesh of your flesh. From this day forth, we are one. And then he would make the same declaration to me. From this day forth, you know, blood of blood and flesh of flesh. From this day forth, we are one. And from that day forward, from then on, because the people of those cultures understood blood covenant, the concept was we were now not individuals, but we had become one in life. His life in me, my life in him. We are now one person. We're separate, but we're one. And so because of the Berith and what it represented, when people would see him, and if they knew who we were in covenant with, they would see him as me, and they would see me as being him. Now, another thing about the covenant meal was that every now and then, and this wasn't consistent with every covenant, but there are records that periodically these individuals would get back together maybe once a year, every few weeks, twice a year, whatever, or the tribes would come back together and they would celebrate the establishing or the cutting of the covenant. In that, they would go through the covenant meal. Now, they wouldn't cut and draw the blood again, but they would do strictly the bread, and then if they had the meat, they'd do the meat as well. And then they would also do the wine, but the wine, they referred to it as blood. Even though it wasn't real blood, they would refer to it as blood. And when they would go through the covenant meal again, it was reaffirming what they had done. It was, they would get together to go through the process of the covenant meal to remember what they had entered into, to remember the blood covenant that they had established with each other. Okay, now the next page of your syllabus, it says the next thing that we would do is we would plant a tree. So we would take like a seedling and we would plant this tree somewhere that the two of us would pass by on a frequent basis. Maybe it was the road to town or whatever it would be. But we would plant that tree somewhere that each of us frequented or passed by quite often. And this tree was to be a reminder of the covenant that we had. This planted tree was to serve as a consistent, we have so much. We have the robes, we have the scar on the hand, I mean all this, but the tree also was a reminder. And so as we would see this tree, it would establish or it would reference the fact that our covenant, our berith, this is a strong thing. It is a living thing that cannot be disannulled. And not only that, but as the tree would grow, it symbolized the fact that our covenant was growing stronger and our covenant was becoming more alive. And our covenant, because as a tree would grow, even a tree that's not a fruit tree, the very fact that it grows, it gives off shade, and so on and so forth. So there are benefits to any tree, even if it doesn't bear fruit. And so as our tree would grow, regardless of what kind of tree that it was, its growth symbolized the increasing benefits of us being in this blood covenant with each other. And if other people would see it, we could tell them about it. Oh, that's our covenant tree. Well, all we had to do was say that. Or if the two of you were passing by and you knew that he and I had entered into this berith and you knew that that was the tree, you could look to your friend and say, you see that tree right there? That's the tree that Jimmy Miller and Jim Martin planted. That is their covenant tree. Well, that's all you had to say. That, Martin and Miller, you know them? All right, that's their covenant tree. That's all you had to say. That other person immediately would know, oh, wow, these guys have entered into a berith. Man, I'll have to keep that in mind in case I ever want to do business. But then because if I do business with the one, I'll also be doing business with the other. There can be benefits to engaging in business affairs with people who have a berith. And so here we have this covenant established. And now, from this time forward, we refer to each other as friends. And this word friend, it's lost a lot of its meaning today. I mean, everybody's everybody's friend. But back in those days, when you would refer to somebody, and, in different languages, it was a different kind of a word, but when you would use the word friend, the covenant friend word, in each language, I would say, well, he is my friend. They would know. Just say we came into a party, and I was introducing him to all of you, and I would say, hey, everybody, this is Jimmy Miller. This is my friend. Instantly, everybody in the room knew those are berith partners. Those are blood covenant partners. And you don't mess with them. And they represent each other's strength. They represent, in other words, it carried so much weight in the minds of the people who heard this. They realized that if you see the one, you're seeing the other. Okay, now, it's hard for me to not jump off on a bunch of rabbit trails and to stay just on this. But if you see Jimmy, you're seeing me. What'd Jesus say? If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. Okay? Are you with that? You see what I'm saying? You understand what I'm getting at here about how when you understand covenant, you can go through the New Testament and you can see covenant over and over and over again. Remember when Jesus was praying, Father, you and I are one, but I pray that they would be one. You and me and you, them and us. That's a covenant term. That was a covenant prayer. And because of the impact and the strength of blood covenant, when Jesus prayed that prayer, being a covenant term, what it was saying is, when they see you, or when people see them, they're going to see you. They're going to see me. When people see them, they're going to see our life in them. They're going to see them, even though they won't see us in their presence, they'll know they are us. Which is exactly what Jesus was trying to get across. And if you read in John chapter 6, John chapter 6 is such a powerful covenant chapter. We're going to get into it later on in this course. But this is, I'm telling you right now, when you understand these things and you go back and start reading the New Testament, you're going to pick up on covenant terms over and over again. And you're going to get a better understanding of one of the reasons why the Jews came so hard against a guy like Paul and why they came so hard against Jesus. It wasn't just that Jesus, they said he was coming against the law. Well, the law was the law of Moses, but the law of Moses was established based upon the covenant of Abraham. So when Jesus comes along and he's preaching and teaching the kingdom, the Jews did not hear the truth. All they heard was, you're going to violate the covenant. You're going to violate what the blood, you're going to violate the berith that we have with God through Father Abraham. That was their concept. What they couldn't seem to understand was that Jesus was coming along to give them something that was going to be better than the covenant they had through the animal blood. He was going to give them a berith for all eternity. But they couldn't grasp the truth of this. Okay, now look in your outline. From now on, we call ourselves friends. And if you turn over to Exodus chapter 3, and let's hear it for my covenant partner. Hallelujah.
This is for all time.
Yeah, this There you go. Now, in Exodus chapter 3, whoops, let me turn over there and get caught up with you. Genesis, Exodus. God is approaching Moses. And it says in verse 1, now Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law. And it says that his father-in-law is the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the backside of the desert. Then it says, and he came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. And Moses said, I will now turn aside to see this great sight, why this bush is not burnt. And when the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called unto him out of the midst of the bush, said, Moses, Moses. And he said, here am I. He said, draw not nigh hither, put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. Now, why was that? It wasn't just because he heard a voice. It was because when God spoke to him, he says, Moses, I am the God that your grandpappy Abraham entered into covenant with. I am the berith partner of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the moment that Moses heard this, he fell to his face, not just because he was hearing the voice of a God, but because he was hearing the voice of the berith God, the one who was the supreme God of all gods, and not just because he was the supreme God, he is my covenant partner, because if he's the covenant God, the berith God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that means I'm now in the presence of my berith partner, the one who's going to stand beside me all the time, the one that is going to honor the blood of the sacrifice. He is the one one that we've been looking for all of these years. This is the reason he fell on his face. It was because he finally had met up with his bereaved partner. And God, when God made that statement, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, what he was saying is, I am the God of the blood covenant that cannot be broken. He was making reference to the fact that this blood covenant that goes all the way back to Abraham, it is carried forth from generation to generation to generation. And I, God, I, the bereaved partner, am here this day and I am still honoring this blood covenant. So Moses hears this and he falls on his face and he begins to worship him. You know the story how God began to speak to him. Now, if a bereaved were broken, it meant the death of the one who broke it. And if it was between individuals, the bereaved breaker faced death. But if it was between two tribes, an entire tribe could possibly be killed. Now turn over to Jeremiah chapter 34. Jeremiah 34. I'll show you a reference to this. God is speaking. And in verse 18 he says, "And I will give the men that have transgressed my covenant, which have not performed the words of the covenant which they made before me, when they cut the calf in twain and passed between the parts thereof, the princes of Judah and the princes of Jerusalem, the eunuchs and the priests and all the people of the land which passed between the parts of the calf, I will even give them into the hand of their enemies and into the hand of them that seek their life, and their dead bodies shall be for meat unto the fowls of the heaven and to the beasts of the earth." So God is, you can see here, he's making reference to a bereaved. And what he's saying is these guys have broken the blood covenant. They're going to die. Now if you look over in Joshua chapter 9, you're going to see another example, the beginning of another example of this whole concept of the eternal nature, if you will, of a blood covenant. In Joshua chapter 9, I'll tell you what, let's do this. I don't know that I'm going to finish this in the last couple of minutes that we have. Let's go ahead and take a break right now. Come back in 8 minutes and we'll pick up here and finish up for the night.